Well, hello. Good to see you. I want to welcome all of our churches that are joining in today. I'm really excited about this series, Plan B, where we are looking at what do we do when God doesn't show up in our life the way that we thought he would or the way that we think he should. What do we do when life doesn't turn out the way that we thought it would go? That's what this series is all about. And today we're looking at one of my favorite people in the Old Testament, a guy by the name of David. And we're going to jump right into David's story today. I want to invite you to follow along, grab that outline out of your program. And we're going to look at his story, which is found in the book of 1 Samuel. And if you're new to the Bible, I want to invite you, well, even if you're not new to the Bible, I want to invite you to read his story this week. And I'm going to paraphrase kind of a lot of it for you today. But would you go back and reread it on your own? If you don't have a Bible, we'd love to give you one. At any of our churches, just stop by the information, one of the information areas where there's a big sign, "Can I help you?" And they will give you a Bible in English or Spanish, your choice. If you don't read Spanish, I'd recommend not getting that one. And grab one of those Bibles and start reading David's story, because we're going to look at today, and I think you'll find it pretty fascinating. Now, even if you're not a Bible, Jesus, church person, you know who David is, because his most iconic story is still talked about today in sports and in the business world. And it is simply known by two names, David and Goliath. Yeah, I mean, if you're not a Bible person, you've heard that. Because when the underdog wins and takes out the projected champion, the team that nobody thought could lose, they call it a David and Goliath story. And we pick up with David in 1 Samuel chapter 16. If you look on your outline, I just reference it there for you. David is the eighth in line of boys in his family. And so he is out watching his family's sheep, and they are, you know, farmers, and he's out watching the sheep. And a guy by the name of Samuel shows up, and he knocks on their door, and he meets with David's dad, Jesse, and he says, "Hey, I'm sent here by God because one of your sons is going to be the next king of Israel." And so he's like, wow, you know, and in that culture at that time, you would think it would be the oldest, and it wasn't. It turns out that Samuel says, "David, David is the one." And he anoints him with oil. They kind of have this ceremony in that moment. And can you imagine, as a teenager, all of a sudden there is this God-given dream planted in your heart that one day you would be king? And now David doesn't immediately go to the palace in Jerusalem and kind of take over. He kind of goes back to watching the sheep. But there's this God-given dream placed in his heart that, man, David, you're going to be something special. You're going to do special things. And Scripture makes it clear from that day forward, when David was anointed to be the future king, God was with him in a very special way. Well, fast forward just a little bit, and Saul, the current king, he is becoming mentally unstable. And the reason that David was anointed by a prophet to be the new king is because Saul had been turning his back on God. He's becoming very mentally unstable. And so some of Saul's inner circle, like, maybe if we can get some good music in here. And when he kind of gets in his fits of rage, that somebody could play some soothing music. And one person in Saul's entourage apparently one time had been walking by David when he was with his sheep and was like, "Hey, I know this boy. He plays a mean harp. Well, let's go get him. His name's David. He's son of Jesse." I mean, read the story. That's how it went. And so they go get David out of the field. And imagine now David finds himself in the service of the king. The eighth in line, who, you know, probably projects that his life is going to be nothing more than what he's currently doing, shepherding. But he had this God-given dream, and he's like, wow, maybe it can come true, because here I am. I mean, from the fields to the palace. And so he's now in the service of the king, and he would go back and forth in different seasons and times, and he would go back to the fields. And then at other times he would be, you know, with Saul for maybe a few days or a few weeks at a time. But David would, you know, play and sing. Now, David is this, Scripture records, he is good looking, all right? He is brave, and he is talented. So ladies, think Brad Pitt in Troy, all right? If you haven't seen that movie, you might want to. And guys, he's the guy you love to hate, because he just kind of has it all going for him. Because not only is David a great musician, turns out David is an incredible warrior. And because in one story, and this is where you can read it, this is the David and Goliath story, you already know it. David is going to take his brothers some food, his three oldest brothers on the front lines, as Israel is in a war, a battle with a neighboring nation and people group called the Philistines. And there was a giant, the number one warrior for the Philistines, Goliath, that every day would stand out there and he would taunt. And he'd say, hey, not army versus army, man versus man. Bring me your greatest warrior, your greatest soldier. Let's go one-on-one for the whole thing. And he would taunt and he would mock. And David shows up just to deliver some food. He's still a young man, a teenager at this time. And he hears this giant taunting his nation and his God. And David is indignant. He's like, who does this guy think he is? And everyone else is like, oh, the 8-foot giant. That's who he thinks he is, you know? Like, and David, and so he's like, will anybody today face me? And David yells out from the back, I will. And everybody else in the army is like, I didn't say it, you know? Like, who said that? And all of a sudden this teenager like walks up and he's like, I did. And scripture says that Saul tries to talk David out of it. Like, what are you thinking? Which, by the way, that would be wisdom, right? I mean, you should try to talk musicians out of battles. The skinny jeans and scarves are always going to hold them back, all right? Musicians usually aren't good warriors. But it turns out David wasn't just a great musician. He was a great warrior. And you know the rest of the story, and if you don't, you can read it. David says, Saul tries to give him all this armor and all this stuff, and David's like, that's not me. I can't do that. And he takes his slingshot, which he'd been using to protect his sheep, picks up 5 stones, only needed one, faces that giant. The Philistine army is mocking, laughing. David starts swinging, lets one shot go. There was really only one exposed place in the giant's armor, right here in the forehead. And it says that David hits him in the right here, and the stone literally sinks in his head. Boom, one shot, giant down, dead. David walks up, takes the giant's own sword. This is where it gets like Braveheart-ish, guys. Like, you need to read the Bible. It's good. And pulls the sword out that he can probably barely lift at this point as a teenager and cuts off the giant's head with his own sword. And it leads to a rout of the Philistine army. From that day forward, David never goes back to the fields. And he is in the service of the king, and he becomes the most famous warrior in the history of Israel. And David went on to win battle after battle after battle. They would sing songs in the street about him. David would come back with his own, he developed his own kind of squadron of men in the Israelite army called David's Mighty Men, about 400 of them. And they were just unstoppable. And they would come back from battle and the streets would erupt in song, and they created these songs. And this is where Saul started getting jealous, because the song went like this, that Saul has killed his thousands, that's the current king, but David his 10,000s, and everybody would go crazy. And so you can imagine, like, behind the scenes at this point, Saul is getting a little jealous. But everything for David is going up and to the right. In fact, Saul offers one of his daughters in marriage. And so again, imagine David, he's like, wow, maybe this God-given dream that I could, maybe it could be true. I mean, I'm in the service of the king. I'm a celebrated warrior. Like, I'm offered one of the king's daughters. I'm now going to be in the royal family. Like, and guys, you need to read what David had to do to get the king's daughter's hand in marriage, because you think you had it bad with your father-in-law. Woo! You need to read the story, because it is crazy. Anyway, it's referenced in there what he had to do. I guarantee you it's more than you had to with your father-in-law. But anyway, so he gets the king's daughter, and chapter 18 ends with David winning. David is winning in politics, he's winning in popularity, he's winning in battle, and he's winning in love. I mean, everything in David's life is going up and to the right. And I think for us, we like it when life is going that way, right? When it just, everything seems to be falling in place. Our hopes and dreams and plans just seem to be like happening. And for today's purposes, we're going to call that plan A. And you can write this down. The truth is, we all have or had a plan A. Meaning we all had dreams and goals and visions of what our life would be like what that ideal relationship would be like, and how one day we'd meet the one and get married and happily ever after, and that perfect job and that perfect career, and that we'd get that house and we'd get pregnant easily, and all these hopes and dreams and desires. And the truth is, a lot of those hopes and dreams and desires are even God-given. Hear me today, I'm not saying that those are bad. Because probably a lot of them, if you're walking with Jesus and you're living surrendered to him, those are going to be God-given hopes and dreams and desires and goals. Because think about David. Remember, it wasn't David's idea to be king, right? I mean, David wasn't sitting gazing at the palace like Aladdin singing, riff raff, street rat. I don't buy that. If only they could see me. Like, that's not David, right? I should have tried out for Aladdin when I was in high school. But anyway, that's not David. David's not like, oh, I could be so much more. He's just minding his own business, tending the sheep. And all of a sudden, a guy shows up and like, you're going to be the next king. And so understand, this is a God-given dream. And so David is thinking everything's going great, but we see things start to crumble. His plan A starts to fall apart in chapters 19 through 21. And again, just let me give you the summary, and I hope you'll read it on your own this week. Saul is becoming more jealous of David. He's becoming violent. And in his fits of rage and his mental instability, David still would show up and try to soothe him by singing and playing the harp. And in this one instance, when you read it in chapter 19, David is singing and playing the harp, and Saul is so jealous and angry and full of rage towards David that in the middle of one of David's songs, Saul picks up a spear, throws it across the room, and tries to impale him on the wall. David manages to get out of the way and escapes the king's chambers with his life. And David's wife, the king's own daughter, has to kind of come up with a lie to tell the guards. So David is able, in a panic, and like to run for his life. And he flees the palace and runs away. Now, David, think about this. This is David you're talking about. I mean, the warrior of all warriors, the hero of all heroes. He's never run from anything or anyone once in his life. And he finds himself on the run alone, kind of in fear and in panic. And he ends up in this small village called Nob. And it's in the middle of the night, and he doesn't know where to go or what to do. And so he goes to the temple, and he finds a priest there. And what David does next, at this point, David's kind of winging it, right? I mean, it's one of those moments where things didn't go as he thought, and so he doesn't know what to do because everything in his life has just kind of happened. It's just gone well for him. And now he's at a place it's not. And so David lies to the priest, and he says, hey, because the priest is asking him a question. Why are you here by yourself, dude? Because David at this point is a celebrity. Like, he's famous. I mean, he had an entourage for David's mighty men. Like, David doesn't, go around the countryside by himself. And so the priest thought it was weird. Like, what are you doing here? And he's like, well, I'm actually on a secret mission from the king, and I need you to give me food and supplies. And then he's like, do you happen to have a weapon around? Because I left in such a hurry, I even forgot my sword. And what happens next is truly amazing. The priest says, oh, as a matter of fact, we do have a weapon here. We have a sword. And David, you'll know this sword very well, because it's the very sword you used to cut off the giant's head. Now, don't miss what's happening here. David is running. He is in fear. He's in panic. His plan A is falling apart. And what does God do? God placed a reminder of his faithfulness right in David's path. That sword was kept there as a monument to God's faithfulness for the people of Israel. That when they saw that, when people would walk in that temple, they'd remember this great day that a young teenager stood up to a fierce warrior of the Philistines, and that God, not David, but God delivered them through the hand of David. And David is on the run, and he's living in fear, and he's panicked, and plan A is falling apart. And I think in that moment, God is trying to get David's attention. He's saying, David, like, here's this sword that you accomplished something that nobody thought was possible. And you did that because you trusted in me. And I think God's trying to get his attention, saying, David, you don't need to run. You don't need to panic. You don't need to live in fear. Would you trust me again? And I think God does the same thing for you and I when our plan A falls apart. He tries to get our attention and let us know that he is still in control, even though our life might be out of control, that he is still faithful, even though maybe people around us have been unfaithful. And I think for some of you, you're here today because this is your sword moment. I mean, you showed up today at the invitation of a friend, or maybe you've been gone for a long time and this is your first week back, or maybe you show up every week, but this is a moment I believe God has planned to remind you that he is still in control, that he is still faithful. And I think God does for us what he did for David in this moment. And God doesn't promise in those moments that everything's going to be easy or predictable or it's all going to just magically get better, okay? That's fantasy land. But Jesus, in fact, did say that he would always be with us and that he would never give up on us. And so we need to be careful when plan A starts falling apart that we don't give up on God. Because I think at some level, for a moment, David had given up on God. He had forgotten what he knew to be true about God in his life. And here's the problem. You can write this down. When we give up on God, we often fall into harmful behaviors. I think David had done this. I mean, think about it. David's running. He's never run from anything or anyone. He's living in fear and a panic. He's never lived in fear or a panic. At some level, we could say that David abandoned his wife. She actually gets questioned and threatened for aiding and helping him escape. And think about this. David lied in church to a priest. Does it get any worse, right? And so this is David. He's running. His behavior has changed because I think his trust in God has changed. And the danger is when plan A falls apart, we often try to take shortcuts and we try to stay in control. We try to cope with our disappointment and disillusionment in some way. And when we do that, when we reach for coping mechanisms or we just try to hang on to control, we hurt ourselves and ultimately we hurt the people closest to us. This is what you're going to see happens to David, and this is what happens to us when pain and difficulty hit our life. If rather than surrender it and be healed by God, we try to cope and hang on. If you look at the bottom of your outline on the back, I recommended a couple books there. One of them is what this series is based on, and just want to acknowledge that and give credit. There's a book called Plan B by Pete Wilson. Great book, and much of what we're talking about today is based on that book. And so if this kind of triggers something in your heart, I'd recommend that you pick that up. But the other book mentioned there is Emotionally Healthy Spirituality. And author Peter Scazzaro writes about this issue of coping rather than getting healing and holding on rather than letting go. And let me read to you from his book. It'll be on the screen. Here's what he says. In our culture, addiction has become the most common way to deal with pain. We watch television incessantly. We keep busy running from one activity to another. We work 70 hours a week. We indulge in pornography, overeat, drink, take pills, anything to help us avoid the pain. Some of us demand that someone or something, a marriage, a sexual partner, an idea of family, children, an achievement, a career, or even church, take the loneliness away. Sadly, the result of denying and minimizing our wounds over many years is that we become less and less human, empty Christian shells with painted smiley faces. For some, a dull, low-level depression descends upon us, making us nearly unresponsive to all reality. Some of you know exactly what that feels like, because when plan A fell apart, you started coping rather than seeking healing. And you started trying to feel in control in some area. But the end result of your coping or trying to hang on was that you felt even more lost or more empty. And I think this is where David finds himself, in that temple with that priest. He's trying to wing it and he's trying to figure it out himself. And this guy who had always trusted God, who was full of courage and bravery, not because of who he was, but because of who he knew God was in him, all of the sudden is kind of trying to wing it and figure it out on the run. And I think what David realized, if not on that night, in a few nights to come when you read his story, is something that probably all of us have realized in our life if we've lived a little bit of life, and if you haven't realized it yet, you will, and you can write this down, is that the greatest illusion of all is the illusion of control. See, I think maybe David probably started to buy into his own hype a little bit. Wow, look at me, look what I've done. I always win, every battle I win. I never lose. Nothing ever goes wrong for me. Everything in David's life was just always up and to the right. And I think at some point he had kind of bought into his own hype. And all of a sudden, the greatest illusion of all that David finally came to realize is the illusion of control. How many of you have ever had one of these? All right, and by these, I don't mean the exact, pirate. You're like, oh, I had a pirate puppet too, because that would be really weird. This is a marionette puppet, and I'm actually terrible at these. The strings, if I'm left to my own devices with this for probably 5 minutes, they get all crisscrossed, and it looks like my puppet's having a seizure or something. But a skilled puppeteer, which is a real thing. You can go to Balboa Theater, actually, and watch a skilled puppeteer. But a skilled puppeteer can maneuver the puppet at their will by simply moving the strings. Now, I can't really do anything except maybe the Running Man here. That's not even the Running Man. That's like a weird white guy dance, okay? That's about how I dance right there. But a skilled puppeteer, like, they can actually maneuver this based on the strings, by just moving the right one at the right time. And I think in our Western Americanized culture, we can believe that we are in total control of our life. And we believe that we have a string that runs through our finances. And we're in control of that. And we manage that well. And we nailed the interview. And we got the job. And we make the decent money. And we're smart and wise. And we save. And we do all the right things. And so we think that, man, it's just everything's always going to go well in that area because we got it. And I think that we believe we have a string to our health. And like nothing bad is ever going to happen to us. And maybe, you know, you take care of yourself. And you work out and you eat well. And so you're like, man, I got that one locked in. And we got a string it to our relationships. And maybe we're like, okay, I'm in control of my marriage. And another one to our kids. And then become teenagers. And you realize that one's an illusion. Which if you weren't here for the previous 3 weeks, you need to go back and listen to that series. But we begin to think that every area of our life, like, man, we got it. We're in control. But have you had those moments in life where you finally realize control's an illusion? You can do all the right things, but that doesn't mean that you are still in control. And I think we've all had moments like that. I think we've all had moments where, maybe we got a letter and we opened it and it said, your home's being foreclosed on. And the illusion of control, wow. Or maybe we get called into HR and they say, I'm sorry, we're going to eliminate your position. Or maybe you heard words from a spouse and you thought, man, you had it in control. And they said, I've met someone else. Or, any number of things. Your physical health, that you went to the doctor and you thought everything was fine. And then after a few tests, the doctor calls you in and they say, hey, I'm sorry, but it's cancer. All of a sudden, that thought that we were in control, it vanishes real fast. And usually following words that we read or we hear in moments like that is we try to keep a death grip, right? And we're like, well, I got to stay in control. But we get more and more frustrated because we realize that control is really an illusion. And I think David found himself at this place. But even when you find yourself in those powerless moments of life where you realize, man, the truth is I'm not in control. You are still in control of one thing. And if you hear nothing else today, I hope you hear this. Write it down. The only real control we have is how we respond to disappointment and obstacles. That's the only thing we're in control of. We might own our own business. We might run our own thing. We might be financially secure. But the truth is, and we all know it deep down, any of those things can change in a moment. And when they do, and when life slaps you in the face, and it always has a way of doing that, the thing that we are still in control of is how we respond in those moments. David wasn't in control. Here he thought everything was always going well, and all of a sudden just a crazy king wrecks his life. But David was still in control of how he could respond. And when the bottom falls out and you find yourself in plan B, there's three possible responses. Write these down real quick. The first one is you can choose to let it control you. How many of you thought that feeling was going to be let it go? Let it go. Okay. Too many Disney references in one sermon. I need to get out more, right? You can tell I have elementary age children. I know all the songs. Response number one in the face of disappointments and obstacles is that you can simply let it control you. You get hurt, you get disappointed, and you let resentment and bitterness reside in your heart, and you carry that around from relationship to relationship, from job to job. You let a river of rage or anger or fear or insecurity just run its course in your life, and it carves out what your life will be. We've all known people and know people who, for some reason, they've never moved towards healing from the pain in their past. And the truth is, at some level, they choose to carry the pain from their past into their present. And they've never experienced or sought true healing. And they just let that disappointment control them. Another option is that, another possible response is that we just keep trying harder. In other words, we just think like, okay, well, that one, that messed up. I'm gonna control the things I can control. And the truth is, this idea of trying harder, this usually results in compounding our pain. This is a lot of people's, what's the right word I'm looking for? I think the reason there are some people who walk away from Jesus and walk away from their faith is because they're disillusioned when pain hits. And the reason is because they never heard a true gospel. There's a gospel meaning the good news Jesus story. There is a perverted version of the good news Jesus story that a lot of people in Western, Americanized, you know, middle class and up culture buy into. And that is that if we follow Jesus and we check all the right religious boxes and we follow all the rules, that everything in our life is always going to be up and to the right. And Jesus never said that, and Jesus never taught that. And so when crap hits our life, and when a spouse walks out, or when we get the report of cancer, or when a child dies, all of a sudden our faith, and obviously those are horrific things, but our faith is wrecked because we think, well, God promised that everything would always go well. Jesus never said that. This isn't in your notes, but John 16:33, if you want to write it off to the side. One of the last things Jesus said to his very, very best friends was, in this world you will have trouble. Trouble will come. Trouble will find you. Jesus told his followers regularly that if you follow me, if you live my ways instead of culture's ways, you will be persecuted. You will be misunderstood. Like this is part of the deal. Yeah, those are things I think in the American church we never talk about. But Jesus didn't just say, in this world you will have trouble. He said, but take heart. In other words, be brave, have courage. Why? Because Jesus said, I've overcome the world. And so in those moments when life slaps us in the face, don't try to just, you know, keep trying harder and I'm going to control it and you know, God, why are you doing this? Because I've done all the right things. Don't ask the question why. One of the things we've said around here for years is ask the question what. Like, what is it you want me to do, Lord? How is it you want me to respond? What is it that I can learn? How is it that I can grow in the middle of this? Because Jesus promises to be with us in the worst that this life can offer. And I think David went down this path of trying harder for a while. When you read the story, obviously he keeps kind of running from his life. His mighty men, you know, they hear what happens and they're kind of disillusioned with Saul's leadership anyway. They're loyal to David. They leave and start following David. And this cat and mouse game ensues where David and his men are running through kind of the desert and the mountains of Israel. And Saul and his men are in hot pursuit and this chase occurs. But there is a third option. What's the third option? Write this down. The third option, and this is where healing is found, is you surrender control. And the truth is, this is a daily decision. You surrender control. When you read David's story, you see that ultimately he came to a place again of trusting in God for the outcomes. Instead of trying to wing it and make it happen and figure it out himself, he goes back to what won him victory after victory after victory, which is simply trusting in God, believing that God was in control. Yes, David had a part to play in that. He had to take action and step out in faith, and you're going to see that in this next part of the story. So David is still on the run. Let me summarize 1 Samuel 24. And again, please read it this week. Fascinating story. He's still on the run with 400 men. Saul is pursuing him with 3,000. David's hiding in the caves of the Engedi Oasis, part of the Engedi Desert. I've actually visited there. I had the privilege to visit there when I went to Israel. This is a picture of one of the most prominent caves there in the Engedi Oasis. And you can see in that ravine, there's actually a little bit of life because inside of that cave is the Engedi Spring. And it is this cave where 1 Samuel 24 is believed to have taken place. And Saul is marching around that desert area looking for David. And it says in 1 Samuel 24 that the king goes into a cave to relieve himself. Hebrew translation, drop a deuce, okay? That's what that means. Because, I mean, guys, you know this, you don't go into a cave, you know, for number one, right? Like, we're guys, like, you know, I mean, in public restrooms, there's not even walls between the urinals, you know, like, you just are standing there. So, I mean, you don't go into a cave for number one. And so he goes into a cave and all of his men are standing outside because he's the king, and even kings do that by themselves. And they're outside, for, you know, like, okay, hey, we'll stand watch. And the king goes into the very cave, you guessed it, where David and some of his men are hiding all the way back in the dark. And can you imagine this? The king walks in, and he's in slightly a vulnerable position, right? I mean, his robe's around his ankles, and David's men are like, are you kidding me right now? And when you read it, they turn to David, and they whisper. They're like, dude, go slit his throat. Like, God has delivered him in your hands. Right? On a silver platter or a porcelain throne, like either one of those. But anyway, like God has delivered, like they tell David, like, surely this is the blessing of God. The person trying to hunt us down and kill us is right here, and he doesn't even know we're here. And you got to imagine for a moment, David considers, right? Like, he's like, oh, payback. You've been trying to kill me? Well, I'm going to kill you. Or you know, you got to think he has this moment where even maybe he justifies it spiritually. Like, this is God. Like, man, only the Lord would make this happen. This is amazing. But I think David, and the scripture doesn't say this, but I think David had to kind of pause and had to ask himself, is this how I want to take the throne, so to speak? that one wasn't even intentional. I just caught it because I heard somebody laugh over there. All right? But I think David had to ask himself, is this how I want to be king? Like, do I want them to write songs about this? Like, Saul went into a cave to drop a deuce and David slit his throat. Woo! Like, that's not a good song. Like, you know, is that the story that David wanted to tell his grandkids someday? They're like, Papa, tell us how you became king. He's like, well, I think David had a moment, and you'll see it in his words in just a moment, where he said, man, God, you're in control. This dream that you put in my heart from the time of being a little boy, if you want it to happen, God, you're going to make it happen, and there's nothing I could do or anyone else to stop it. And you're going to see that he surrendered control. And so David spares Saul's life. He doesn't kill him. But what he does do is he sneaks up to him while his robe's around his ankles, and he takes his robe, and he cuts a piece off of it. And then he hides back. Saul finishes his business, starts to leave the cave, and David goes out just to the mouth of the cave where I think he's still kind of, you know, in the dark, but he yells out to Saul, and I want to show you what he says. You can read it on your own this week, but here's what he says to him. 1 Samuel 24:9-15, he said to Saul, why do you listen when men say David is bent on harming you? This day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not lay my hand on my Lord because he is the Lord's anointed. See, my father, look at this piece of your robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but did not kill you. And I think at that moment, Saul dropped another deuce, right? He's like, oh my gosh, he was in there. Like, you got to read between the lines, okay? See that there is nothing in my hand to indicate that I'm guilty of any wrongdoing or rebellion. I've not wronged you, but you're hunting me down to take my life. Here's this shift. Listen to how David now is surrendering control. Listen to this. May the Lord judge between you and me, and the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me. But my hand will not touch you. As the old saying goes, from evildoers come evil deeds. So my hand will not touch you. Against whom has the king of Israel come out? Why are you pursuing me? I'm a dead dog, a flea. Again, listen, may the Lord be the judge and decide between us. May he consider my cause and uphold it. May he vindicate me and by delivering me from your hand. Did you catch the monumental shift there in David's language? What was he saying? God, you vindicate me. God's going to be the judge. God, you decide. You look out. You are in control. And I think it's in this moment David is remembering something that he had always known but for a season of his life had forgotten. And that is, he finally is recognizing the fact that God is God and he is not. And that he's realizing control is simply an illusion. And he surrenders to God and ultimately is like, God, if you want this dream that you put in my heart to happen, you're going to make it happen. And there's nothing I can do to stop it or keep it from happening. And so he realizes that surrendering to God is not just a option, but it's really the only option there is. And so my hope and prayer today has been to inspire you to surrender control. What area of your life have you been holding on to that you think you're in control of and you're the puppet master and you can make it all happen and you can stay in control? And the truth is, you haven't surrendered it to God. Yes, we still have to step out in faith. Yes, there's still a risk. David stepping out of the cave and exposing himself and his men to Saul, it could have gone very bad for him, right? So, I mean, there's an element that we still have to step out in faith. But when David did, Saul, in his mental instability, had a moment of clarity, and he repents. He asked for David's forgiveness, and everything wasn't kind of hunky-dory between them, and David didn't immediately move back in the palace, and everything went great again. But you see, it was in this moment David starts doing the very thing that saw God do amazing things through him, surrendering control and trusting in God. And so what area of your life today do you need to surrender control of, that you've been holding on to, that you've been living your way on your terms? And if you're a Jesus follower, that you just once and for all need to go, all right, Lord, I'm going to live your way on your terms. I mean, what is it in your life that you say, you know what, I'm going to turn that over to God? Is it your business? Is it your career? Is it your finances, your sex life, your relationships, your future? Make the decision today, like David, to surrender control. And let me give you a closing question to consider that I really believe shows us if we've surrendered control and can inspire us to do so. Here it is, write it down, last thing in your outline. What would you do in your circumstances if you were absolutely confident God was with you? How would you live differently this week? If you really believed, see, I think in that darkness of that cave, David like had a moment where he's like, man, what am I doing? I mean, the God who, like, when I was a boy, like, gave me the power and the courage to, like, kill a bear and a lion that was trying to attack the sheep. The God who gave me the courage to stand up to Goliath when nobody would. The God who helped me win battle after battle after battle. Like that God who took me from the fields to the palace. Like what am I doing running and living in fear? God, you are in control. And what would you do different this week if you really believe that? I want you to consider that question and your response today during this next song. I want to invite our bands to come out at all of our churches. And I want to create a moment with this next song where you consider your steps of application today. Where maybe in this moment you let go of the strings. Maybe it's in this moment you surrender your very heart and life to Jesus. And there's no magic prayer you pray. If there is a want to in your heart to follow God and you find yourself in one of those plan B moments where life seems to be falling apart, let God meet you today. This song is called You Make Me Brave, and it talks about living in light of a God who we can say, God, you are in control. You are faithful. You are loyal. You are aware of me, and you love me, and your plans for me are so very good. I want you to stay seated. I want you to experience this song, and then we'll come back and close the service after that. Let me pray for you. God, I thank you that in the middle of our plan Bs, you're still very present. You still love us, and your plans for us are so very good. And so, God, if we're running today, if we're living in fear or insecurity, if an area of our world seems to be falling apart, would you help us surrender that control to you and walk in the confidence that you have us? And that even though our circumstance might not change right now, you can change us in that circumstance. You can change our perspective. You can change our heart. You can give us the wisdom and the courage to move forward through our pain towards healing. So God, help us make those kind of decisions right now in this moment. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you.
crashes over me, crashes over me.